Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And on the show right now, we're going to take a look at the amphibians and reptiles that call Wisconsin home with our guest back with us once again, Josh Kapfer. He's a certified wildlife biologist, a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Whitewater, and is the co-editor, along with Donald Brown, of the book Amphibians and Reptiles of Wisconsin. Absolutely amazing book. I don't know what you're going to learn pretty much everything you want to learn about amphibians and reptiles of Wisconsin by taking a look at that book. But he's here to impart what he knows, a little of what he knows about amphibians and reptiles with you right now. And I hope you'll join in. Tell us about your maybe favorite amphibian or reptile. Let us know your questions about snakes or frogs or toads or salamanders. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Josh Kapfer, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's absolutely my pleasure to be here.
I got to ask you about that. How did the book do? I mean, that book.
Yeah. As far as numbers sold, I guess I don't know exact numbers sold, but UW Press said that it did really well. And, you know, they're a small publisher and a nonprofit publisher. And so it really did well for them. They're very excited about it. And in fact, they've asked us to create a smaller field guide version, a pocket field guide version that we've completed and hopefully will be out in 2027.
Oh, man, we'll want to talk to you about that when it comes out, for sure. Well, tell us about the amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin. And we've got pretty good numbers of each, I believe.
Yeah, so what I often tell people is that we have a sort of nice diversity or species richness of amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin. It's manageable. You get further south in the U.S. and they far, far exceed our numbers. I mean, I lived in North Carolina for 2 years, and the number of salamanders alone in North Carolina is staggering, you know. But we have a manageable diversity, enough that I can teach a weekend workshop and cover all of them. And so we do have a really nice diversity. And, you know, we are located, Wisconsin is located geographically in such a way that we have a lot of natural sort of barriers. We have the Great Lakes around us that create certain habitats. We have major rivers in the Wisconsin and the Mississippi that create areas. We have an unglaciated region, the Driftless region. We're influenced by the Great Plains to the west. We've got the eastern deciduous forest that is in the north and the far east. So we've got really, really cool diversity based on adaptations to the fact that all of these communities exist.
John wants to know, what's the difference between amphibians and reptiles?
That's a great question. So amphibians, generally speaking, have very moist skin that's also very thin. So these amphibians can absorb both moisture, water through their skin. They don't have to necessarily imbibe water or drink water through their mouth. And they can actually absorb oxygen. They can breathe through their skin to a degree. And in fact, that's taken to an extreme by some of our salamander species. They're in the family Plethodontidae. We have the four-toed salamander and the redback salamander. They are in a group called the lungless salamanders. They don't have any lungs. They just absorb oxygen through their skin. Reptiles have thicker skin and they have scales that are keratin or similar to like fingernail material. And they can't breathe through their skin. They can't really absorb oxygen effectively through their skin like amphibians do. They also have hard-shelled eggs, reptiles do, that have to be laid on land. So turtles, even though they live in the water, most of them have to come on land to lay their eggs as reptiles. And amphibians have eggs more like fish eggs, where they're sort of gelatinous and can be laid in the water.
So a skink is, for example, would be a reptile, would it not?
And the correct.
And the salamander, of course, an amphibian. A skink will lay, its eggs are, I think, have a coat, a hard a shell, I should say.
Yes, they do. And that shell, it's not quite as hard as a bird shell. It's kind of leathery, so it's a little bit pliable and flexible, but it is not at all like you can imagine what, if you've ever seen caviar, what caviar looks like is similar to what amphibian eggs would look like, sort of gelatinous and look like they'd be very vulnerable.
See, Cater in Herbster has a question, I believe, or a comment at least. Let's go there. Hi, Cater.
Hey, I've seen a lot of snakes in my life, but one time I was walking down a sunny road and there was a small garter snake sunning, and I walked up towards it, and I don't know if I was hallucinating or what, but, you know, snakes move in a serpentine way, but it went backwards, serpentine, into the grass. And I didn't even think that was possible. Have you ever seen such a thing?
So did it back up, or are you sure you were looking at the head when it was on the road, or were you, you know what I mean? Was it facing towards you for certain?
No, it was, and I know their scales point backwards, and that when they go serpentine, that's what grabs. So yeah, I was like, what's happening here? And I looked at it again, and yeah, the head was moving
left. Okay. So it's possible that, especially if it was if you saw the entirety of the snake body on the road, then obviously backing up in the exact pattern it came out with would be a little more difficult, but not impossible. However, if you saw maybe just part of the snake on the road and the rest of it was back up in the grass, for example, it's a lot easier to imagine that it would just slowly slip its way backwards into that grass. So they can definitely sort of move themselves backwards in a similar serpentine fashion. They tend not to move prolonged periods of time in that fashion, however.
Really interesting. Thanks, Gator. Appreciate the call. Fran in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, yeah, I'm curious. We live by a wetland and we're overwhelmed with mosquitoes over the summer. If there are any reptiles or amphibians that we can look out for that would be mosquito eaters potentially?
Sure. Many of the amphibians in both their adult phases and their larval phases will eat lots of mosquitoes or mosquito larvae. So salamander larvae, for example, are well documented to eat huge numbers of mosquito larvae. So when I say larvae, I mean amphibians. Obviously, they hatch from eggs in the water. They have a larval juvenile form. That is usually, there are some exceptions, but usually they have this fully aquatic larva form that hangs out in the water, swims around, they have gills, and then they metamorphose and they turn into a more terrestrial adult, typically. So as larvae, the juvenile form, salamanders are well-known voracious predators of lots of insects, anything they can fit in their mouths. And in fact, they sometimes sort of compare them to top predators, like a wolf is a top predator in an ecosystem in Yellowstone, but in these tiny little wetland ecosystems, larval salamanders are the top predator, like the wolf of those wetlands. So they eat lots of juvenile or larval salamanders. And then adult frogs, gray tree frogs and things like that are well known for being insectivorous. So they also eat a lot of mosquitoes. Now they eat a lot of other insects as well. They don't just focus on mosquitoes, but they do eat lots of mosquitoes.
Yeah. Fran, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Carl in Eagle River, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a question. I was traveling in South Dakota, and it was way past midnight on a hot, rainy day. And just like night crawlers come out at night, there were thousands and thousands of salamanders all over the road. And I've never seen anything like that. I was wondering if you could explain that.
Sure. Depending on what time of year it was, I'm not sure exactly what time of year this was, but usually there are two periods where we would expect to see big migrations of things like salamanders. So in the spring, they have a tendency to overwinter or spend the winter in upland areas to get below the frost line. And then when it gets warm, they come out and they all migrate en masse towards a wetland, and they have to breed in those wetlands typically. And then at the end of the season, when it might be hotter, like the situation you experienced, All of those larvae that I mentioned before metamorphose, and they turn into closer to an adult salamander with legs, and they come out of the water and breathe with lungs. And then they all migrate en masse to go back to the upland area where they overwinter or they spend the winter. So it was likely the latter situation that you observed, and rainy nights are really good for that, right? That's when they're not going to dry out. So that's that tends to be when you see a lot of those mass migrations happening.
And we get that at least on a different level here in Wisconsin. Even in Madison, there are salamander watch groups, are there not?
Yes, absolutely. And there are groups that will go out. Now, you have to be very careful about doing things on roads at night because there is the potential to be injured or by vehicles. But there are people that go out and help these salamanders across roads when they're migrating, because you can imagine that results in a heavy toll on populations if they're trying to cross those roads going from the wetland to the upland or vice versa. But absolutely. And the Wisconsin DNR, actually on their webpage associated to amphibians and reptiles, they have areas where you can track, you can report road crossings that are in potentially having, that you think might be having an impact. So the DNR likes to know about those things so they can try and monitor those populations.
Carl, thanks again. Appreciate it. Bob in Superior, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
Many years ago, I was walking across a small lake during deer season. No snow, very clear ice, 8-10 inches of perfectly clear ice. And I saw in, you know, water that was maybe 6-8 feet deep several times, I saw painted turtles swimming under the ice. It made me think that they must be able to absorb oxygen through their skin. But did I disturb them? Did I put them into an oxygen debt?
That's a great question. So a couple of things. First, I mentioned that generally reptiles can't absorb oxygen through their skin. There are some exceptions to that. For example, turtles that overwinter underwater, there are some species that can absorb oxygen through tissues that line their oral cavity. And there are some species that can also absorb oxygen through the lining of their anus. So they call that anal breathing. So it is possible that that can happen. And then, you know, a lot of times if they're in areas in water bodies that have access to the surface, that surface water gets well oxygenated better. Like if there's not a solid covering of ice on top of it, that oxygen can better get into the water for them to be able to absorb it through those areas of their skin. But turtles can also use an anaerobic metabolism, it's called, which means they can metabolize and get energy without the need for oxygen. Now, remember, in the winter, they're moving really, really slow. Their metabolism slows way down because they are cold-blooded or ectothermic. So they don't have as big of a metabolic need as they would if they were active. So they don't need as much energy. And so they can burn energy without the use of oxygen. But they can only do that for so long. Now, whether you disturbed it or not and caused an oxygen deficit, it's hard to say. Typically, if turtles don't want to move in those situations, if they're really, really cold, they're slowed down, then they don't move. So while I can't say for certain if you caused that, it seems to me that if they were moving around, they must have felt they had access to enough oxygen.
Bob, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your calling. Christy in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thank you. A few years back, I was at a June meeting of teachers and looked out the window at break and saw a gorgeous timber rattlesnake moving across the parking lot headed towards a street. I grabbed the box, went out, was able to get the snake, bring it home, release it later in the day in the wooded lot. And another participant in the in service said, oh, you can have that snake. My husband wants it to eat the moles. And she had driven from Bloomer that morning to Chippewa. So can a snake ride on the undercarriage of a truck? It would be warm, of course, and a nice place for a snake to be. What do you think?
Well, so It is potentially feasible that that could happen. Sure. It's not completely outside of the realm of possibility, and it's documented in species to be accidentally translocated inside of the, you know, mechanism of a vehicle, as long as they're not next to a moving part or something that would burn them, like direct contact to the exhaust. That's feasible. So Chippewa is, yeah, that, so Chippewa Falls. So that would be, which county is that? I can't think off the top of my head. Chippewa County, sorry. So that would be close to the potential range for that species. They usually are found within the Wisconsin and Mississippi River valleys, and they really need sort of rocky outcroppings and rocky bluffs to be found or to exist. They need those types of habitats. So yeah, it's possible that they could be translocated in a vehicle like that. I don't hear of many documented cases of it with timber rattlesnakes in the upper Midwest, but it's inside the realm of possibility.
Yeah. Christy, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Having some fun today and an interesting time with Josh Kapfer, a certified wildlife biologist, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Whitewater, as we talk with him about our frogs, salamanders, snakes. It's great fun. And you can join in. I hope you will. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Experience to share or question to ask? Join on in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at amphibians and reptiles with our guest, Josh Kapfer, of the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, where he is a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. Renata in Lake Mills has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Renata.
Hi, thank you for having this show. I have a question about mud puppies in the state and how the population is doing. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
So mud puppies are an interesting species. They're a salamander, and so they're also one that, you know, often people who are looking for salamanders aren't looking for salamanders where you find mud puppies, because mud puppies are fully aquatic. So we find them in riverine habitats, we find them in lakes, and that's not generally where you're looking for salamanders. You're looking for salamanders in, you know, ephemeral wetlands and woodlands and things like that. So where we were getting, or where we have gotten the best data on numbers of mud puppies is from fisheries biologists, because they're generally doing survey work for fish in bigger water bodies, and they bring mud puppies up when they're doing the survey work. And so there have been many of the amphibians and reptiles in Wisconsin, we have poor population data on, but we have been trying to accumulate a better understanding about mud puppy populations in the state. And to get an idea, it seems as if their numbers are somewhat declining, but we don't have really good population data on that yet. However, the DNR has been active in a project involving mud puppies in the Milwaukee River. So hopefully there'll be more information on them specifically in that part of southeastern Wisconsin soon.
I was thinking back while you were talking, when I was probably around 9 years old, I was fishing with some pals and caught a mud puppy. And I had never seen one. I didn't know anything about them. It scared the heck out of me when I was expecting to pull up a bluegill or something, and here comes a mud puppy.
Yeah. So honestly, where I have caught them, there's one or two instances where I've been out specifically looking for mud puppies. But where I have caught them has been with friends ice fishing, pulled them up through the ice because they're active in the winter. And then also electroshocking for fish and doing fish surveys. We've shocked up mud puppies. So they're really a cool they're our biggest salamander, you know, the of all of them. The tiger salamander is the biggest terrestrial one. Yeah, they can get good size. With tail, they could even get bigger than that. So they're a very good sized critter. And you would, you know, treat or find them in places where you would be fishing, not infrequently. So,
and later on in life, I think my dad gave me a mud puppy bait for muskie fishing. So I guess muskie will eat a mud puppy if they come across.
That's what they say, you know. And in fact, there are, you know, a lot of it are anecdotal one-off reports, but there are numerous reports of fish species that have mud puppies in their gullets, right? So they're a food source for a number of different fish, and they have a tendency to hang out towards the bottom. Mud puppies do, or hang out in rocks and riprap. So the things that kind of move around in those locations, we can easily envision eating mud puppies.
Brian in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Hey, great show.
Thank
you. Fun to hear about these little-known creatures. Hey, I would like to know a little bit more about slender glass lizards. I understand they're a legless lizard that lives in Wisconsin.
You are absolutely correct, and they are one of my favorite critters. We only have four salamander species here in Wisconsin, and so the legless... this slender glass lizard is a legless lizard. It has some of the bony elements like a pectoral girdle and shoulder girdle that we would imagine legs attaching to, but they don't have these limbs. And so they basically are, without knowledge, look indistinguishable in some cases from a snake. But there are a couple of ways in which you can tell a legless lizard from a snake. First of all, lizards blink, right? So snakes do not have eyelids. So if you get close enough to it and you can see it blinking its eye, then you know that it is a legless lizard. It's a lizard of some type. Also, lizards have external pores or openings for their ears, whereas snakes don't have that. So you can see those on a legless lizard. Then there's some other things, you know, the legless lizard has a really, really long tail compared to a snake, but you have to be able to look at where the vent is, where they go to the bathroom out of, and what proportion of that is the body. But the reason why they're called a glass lizard is because they have the ability to dislocate their tails in different fragments if necessary. And then that tail piece that breaks off keeps wiggling. And so that distracts the predator just long enough for that glass lizard, which is really fast typically, to shoot forward and get away. So it's a really, really interesting, fascinating lizard species here in the state. It is an endangered species, too, only found in a very small pocket of Wisconsin. And then it doesn't show up again until down into central Illinois. So this huge gap between where they are in Wisconsin and where they are elsewhere in the upper Midwest.
Just overall, what's the status of our amphibians and reptiles in the state overall?
Yeah, so overall, we see... We have certain species that are listed as threatened and endangered at the state level. Some are also our potential federal candidates or our federal candidates. Those species are struggling, right? The one that always leaps to mind is the Massasauga, the eastern Massasauga, one of our two rattlesnake species here in Wisconsin. And that one, you know, at one point in time, historic records indicate that it was massively abundant in certain parts of the state. I mean, here in Walworth County, where I am, there are records of huge numbers of quote-unquote rattlesnakes, which, given our location, would have to be Massasaugas and not timber rattlesnakes. And today, you couldn't find a Massasauga in Walworth County. There's just a handful of sites where they currently still exist. But then there are other species that seem to be holding stable. Now, remember, we don't have great population data on these types of organisms for comparison. They're not a game species, generally speaking. So we don't have number data like we do for white-tailed deer or, you know, recreationally harvested fish, for example, where we have better population information. But some of those common species, your American toads, your common garter snakes, they seem to sort of be holding steady. But the ones that are rare continue to be rare. We don't see a lot of improvement there. And the ones that are on the fence, we kind of worry about tipping towards that greater decline. And a lot of that is related to loss of habitat and fragmentation of habitat.
Scott in Elko, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a koi and goldfish pond outside my house, and this year I never had any bullfrogs show up after the ice went out. Can you explain why that is? Every year I've always had a dozen bullfrogs in there, but not this year.
Okay, so just to confirm, after the ice melted in the spring, there were bullfrogs that came out of the pond?
No, that came out of the woods. The ones that were in the pond, I have a rubber liner in it, so everything that was in the pond was dead, but they show up from someplace, so they did not come from the pond.
Oh, okay. So, well, it's hard to know. Usually in the... So, first and foremost, bullfrogs and the very closely resembling green frog here in Wisconsin has to overwinter underwater. So some of our frogs can spend the winter kind of buried in certain places on land, but bullfrogs and leopard frogs and green frogs have to overwinter in the water. So if they are in an environment that freezes solid or if they completely run out of oxygen, then that could result in their mortality during the winter. So the ones that come in, I would assume, are coming from some sort of adjacent water body, and why they didn't come in this year as opposed to other years would potentially have to do with if it was a particularly harsh winter, or if more of them got froze over the winter than normal and there wasn't as many to migrate the distance to your koi pond in the spring. If there was some sort of landscape change that maybe is subtle but you're not aware of, like there's a widening of a road somewhere, or there's a new housing development goes in that might restrict their migration. But if you're close to a water body, bullfrogs tend not to move massive distances to find water bodies in the spring. They have a tendency to sort of stay in the water body they overwinter in.
Scott, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I was thinking back to Scott Craven, who has a pond as well that he made. This probably sounds a little like what Scott had from Elko, but he has no water anywhere close to his house and gets a bullfrog every year, somehow finds its way.
Yep. And I mean, that absolutely can happen. Where I am, we're sort of in the same situation. We have this tiny, tiny little pond in our backyard that was dug in by a previous landowner. We don't have a ton of permanent water nearby, but all summer we have juvenile green frogs that live in that pond, and they're one that need to overwinter in the winter in water. So these juveniles are probably more likely or more prone to migrate, right? They are more likely to go to a new location, and that maybe is when they would run into these other littler wetlands that we find them in sometimes.
Let's talk a little more about frogs for a moment. You know, we have 12 species, I think, of frogs. Mm-hmm. And in general, the frog populations are kind of following what?
So we have one species here in Wisconsin that is currently listed as endangered at the state level, and that is the Blanchard's cricket frog. And that frog is rare. It has very unique habitat needs, especially for overwintering. And so that likely is what is restricting it currently, although we're not entirely sure, because this was another species that existed in massive numbers, even into the 50s and 60s in southern Wisconsin, and then suddenly started to experience this huge decline. So there are some, you know, hypotheses of why that happened, but that would require a little bit more of an in-depth discussion. There are other species that we see holding steady. The American toad is one that kind of is holding steady. We see the green frog I mentioned before kind of holding steady. Then we see some species that overall are sort of declining, it appears, like your tree frog species. Things like the pickerel frog, which is a cold stream type species. So it really runs the gamut. The ones that are super, super common still, like the American toad, that tends to seem like it's more holding steady than some of these other ones. But yeah, the ones that are rare sort of continue to be rare and experience declines.
I'm trying to remember, describe a Blanchard's cricket frog for me, would you?
Sure. They're really they're in some ways nondescript. They're very small though, so yeah. Adult size might be, you know, an inch, and they're kind of bumpy skinned, so they're similar in size to something like a spring peeper or a chorus frog, if you're familiar with those. Their skin tends to be a little more bumpy, and they have oftentimes, from a pattern perspective, they'll have like a different colored triangular shape between their eyes on the back of their head. So sometimes that is a way you can distinguish them from the other small frogs. They have very, very small sort of thin toes. But what one interesting characteristic about them is that they can jump. They can really, really jump far. So to the, you know, many, many orders of magnitude of what you would expect a frog should be able to jump even. So they're really cool. They have all sorts of interesting things about them. So there was research done not long ago that found that many of the individuals in a population of cricket frogs only live for 1 year. So if you can imagine a species like a frog that has to mature, reproduce, have offspring, and all of that stuff from a tadpole in a single 12-month time span. That's really, really fantastic. But it's also probably one of the reasons why they're declining, because they don't live very long on average in the wild.
Yeah. Do they croak or make a noise? Maybe Jeff can find a Blanchard cricket frog.
Yeah, if you can, that'd be great. I always liken their call to people like somebody shaking a bag of like ball bearings together, or a bunch of marbles together, or sometimes like a rain stick, if I've ever heard of, like, seen a rain stick or something. They kind of sound like that to me. But yeah, they have a very distinctive call.
Well, maybe we can find, maybe Jeff will.
Oh, there it is. There's a couple of species calling in there. So in the background, you can, there's some tree frogs calling in the background, which make it a little harder. They're kind of muddying the waters a little, but yeah, if you get a full chorus of them, so that last clip was more of a single individual, but if you get a full chorus where there's lots calling, then you get that sound of like ball bearings or marbles being banged together in a bag.
I was getting that though, from that last little piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. From that last little piece of it. That was really cool. Thanks for finding that for us, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
It very much. So what do they do when it gets cold and the ground freezes, frogs?
So the cricket frogs in particular, and this might be another reason why their numbers have declined. So some of the frogs here in Wisconsin can overwinter while completely submerged underwater, and they can absorb oxygen through their skin as long as that water is well oxygenated. Some species can overwinter on land of our frogs and can produce glycogen-based compound in their liver that helps resist ice crystals from forming inside of their cells. The cricket frogs can't do either of those. So cricket frogs are in this weird position where they can't be submerged and they also can't be fully exposed because they can't produce that protectant, that glucose from their liver. So where we tend to find them overwintering is in things like crayfish burrows along waterways. Then there's these crayfish burrows along waterways, there's a water level underground that doesn't freeze, and the cricket frog kind of migrates up and down in that tunnel as the water level goes up and down, so they can remain maybe partially submerged but still get access to oxygen. So if those types of habitats go away, then that means that cricket frogs don't have anywhere to exist in the winter. And so here in Wisconsin, we're on the edge of their geographic distribution, which always means they're kind of struggling probably anyways, just because we're at the basic edge of where they can hang on. So that might be one of the reasons as well, is if those habitats start to go away, that can affect their persistence in the state.
Josh Kapfer, our guest today, certified wildlife biologist and professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW Whitewater, as we talk with him today about herps, frogs, salamanders, snakes. We haven't got much into snakes yet, but I have some questions. There's a little disease or a problem with some of our snakes in the state I wanted to ask him about. Question for him, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, just a quick mention, we'll talk about how to be a better driver. We'll get an update on a group trying to help Madison's population become healthier. And we'll hear from a woman who sewed clothing for astronauts. How do you sew something that an astronaut's going to wear on the moon or someplace else? We'll find out tomorrow, but right now we're dealing with amphibians today on the show, among other things, with Josh Kapfer of the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, where he is a professor of biological sciences, and it's great to have him with us. Again, questions 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Lori in Oshkosh next. Hi, Lori. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me on. It's a great show. I had a question about frogs in Door County. We used to see, sometime in the spring, I believe, a whole bunch, whether it was they had, hatched or whatever, and migrated. They'd be on the roads. They'd be all over. And I don't see that anymore. So I'm wondering what that was and what might be happening. And unfortunately, I don't know what kind of frogs they were. They were pretty small.
Okay.
But we don't see that anymore. So I wondered if your guest could speak to that.
Sure.
So along the lines of what I was mentioning a little bit earlier with salamanders, frogs also have to do this migration or undertake this migration in both the spring when adults move to wetlands to breed, and then again in the fall when the juveniles, after they've transformed from larvae into adults, leave the pond and go in the uplands to overwinter. So this was likely what you're describing sounds like the situation where a bunch of adults were moving down to a wetland and there was a road that bisected where they were going, or a road between the upland and the wetland where they wanted to overwinter. And so the reason why you don't see as many anymore, there's a lot of potential reasons, but one of them could be because you saw so many on the road and there was a bunch that died due to vehicular strike. It's a very common thing where frog populations have been impacted by vehicle mortalities as part of that migration. Now, there's a lot of other factors that can influence frog declines. I mean, climate change is another one that's progressing rapidly, loss of habitat, etc. So all of these things sort of work against frog populations, which as amphibians that are very susceptible to changes in temperature and also anything in their environment that can be absorbed through their skin, then, you know, they're very susceptible to any change that might cause mortality.
Yeah. Lori, thank you for calling. Diane in Turtle Lake, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind today?
Well, I have a pond on my acreage, and I'm very careful not to use any pesticides, herbicides on my land. But this pond supports some ducks, a whole bunch of frogs, and some salamanders, it seems. I have read that mosquito dunks aren't actually harmful to the animals, because I'm not a real big fan of the mosquitoes that choose to live in this pond. So are mosquito dunks safe, or are some kinds safe, some not?
Dunks?
Dunks, yeah, they're these discs that stop the mosquito larvae from hatching.
Okay.
So this is some sort of pesticide that keeps the mosquitoes in that sort of larval stage so they don't hatch, yeah. I will tell you that I am not aware of any good studies that have investigated the potential impacts on amphibians from those types of pesticides. I know they get used frequently, and I have not seen many reports of mass mortality in frogs as a result of the use of those things, but frequently pesticides, while even if they don't cause mass mortality, something very overt and obvious that we might observe and be able to see, it's possible that there are subtle effects that we don't always see, something that maybe affects their reproductive success. Even though the frog looks healthy, it doesn't succeed in reproduction. And so it's hard to know for sure on that one, because that I am aware of, maybe there have been and I've missed them, but there haven't been good hard science investigations into the impacts that those types of things have on amphibian development, amphibian survival, and amphibian populations.
All right. Diane, thank you very much for calling. I was thinking about that. I mean, those animals, the frogs and so forth, they eat a lot of mosquitoes.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the difficulty is that, you know, in a pond that produces lots and lots and lots of mosquitoes, you know, the system sort of gets swamped, and that's what mosquitoes sort of bank on, right? And so obviously those larval amphibians, the larval salamanders particularly, larval frogs don't eat mosquitoes. They scrape algae and stuff like that from the surfaces. But the larval salamanders in particular, they do eat a lot of mosquito larvae. But, you know, whether it's enough to be a noticeable difference to you is another issue. Now, if they weren't there, you'd probably got a lot more, right? But
Greg in Madison, your turn. Hi, Greg.
Hello, I have a question. I was in Hayward this summer, and we encountered a snake with a rattle. And I was told, it's not venomous, it's a constrictor, it had a replica rattle. It was either a snake or a pine snake or something. And then I've just, while I was listening now, you had mentioned two rattlesnakes. Wisconsin didn't have any venomous rattlesnakes, and now you've mentioned two down by the Mississippi, and then you just mentioned another one. So I don't know, do we have venomous rattlesnakes? And what was this snake I encountered in Hayward?
Yeah, so you wouldn't have encountered, I don't think, a rattlesnake in Hayward.
No, that's correct, Larry. There, you wouldn't have encountered a rattlesnake in Hayward. Their range, and in fact, previously the caller had mentioned Chippewa Falls, and that's also just slightly outside of the range of the timber rattlesnake, which she had mentioned. They're closer to the river, but the rattlesnake species that are found in Wisconsin are the Massasauga is one of them, and that's one that's associated with wetlands, but also today only really found in a couple handful of sites further south than Hayward. And then there's the timber rattlesnake, which is found along the Wisconsin and Mississippi River valleys in these sort of rocky bluff type habitats. Now, what you probably saw, if they called it a pine snake. So when my dad was growing up, he was from Neillsville, which is over by Marshfield in Clark County. And he grew up calling what is today known as an eastern fox snake. He would call that a pine snake because it hung, you know, they found it in pine plantations in the central part of the state. And so that fox snake will vibrate its tail when it's threatened. And if it happens to hit like dry grass or dry leaves, it might mimic a rattlesnake. And so that would be where the confusion lies. Now, there's a couple ways you can tell rattlesnakes from non-venomous snakes here in Wisconsin. First of all, rattlesnakes have elliptical pupils or cat's eye pupils. You can usually see that from a distance, but you don't want to get too close, obviously. Whereas our non-venomous snakes have round pupils. You can look at the head shape. A rattlesnake has more of an arrow-shaped head when looking down. But some of our non-venomous snakes, when threatened, will flatten out, and they'll get that sort of appearance to their head. So that's not always a great indicator either. But when a rattlesnake moves, it usually has the tip of its tail up in the air, like pointing straight up, and that rattle then can be vibrated as it's sort of moving away. Whereas a non-venomous snake doesn't do that. That when it's moving around, that tail is flat against the ground, generally speaking.
Greg, there you go. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Mary in Lebanon, on to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, I found a snake. Well, first I was shocked because it was in my basement, and I touched it with a pole, just a broom handle, to see what it was, because it thought, and then it wiggled. So then I figured I had a snake. So I put on some gloves and I just carried it outside, and it really wiggled and so on. And the only thing I can compare it to is the picture of a worm snake.
So
looked like a shoelace.
Yeah, there's. There are a couple of species here in Wisconsin that have that same kind of general appearance. Two are really, really common, and two are incredibly rare. So the worm snake is one of those that's incredibly rare. It's only known from a handful of sites here in the state. The other really rare one is the line snake, and that one was first found in 2011. We didn't even know we had it in Wisconsin until very recently. It's only known from a couple of spots. But then there are two that are pretty common. One is the brown snake, or Decay's brown snake, as it's sometimes called. Very kind of nondescript brown looking snake above, and doesn't get very big. It's about the size of maybe a big earthworm even. And then there's another one called the red-bellied snake that's also quite common. And below it has a sort of bright orangey red belly, but from up top, it's kind of a browny gray color, sort of nondescript. And so those all can get accidentally sort of mistaken for each other. So my guess would be it was either a northern brown snake or a red-bellied snake, because they also frequently will get sort of accidentally, they accidentally enter people's basements when they're looking for an overwintering spot. It's not uncommon for that to happen with those snakes.
Yeah. Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Tom and Oconto will go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. A couple other predators that you haven't mentioned. I've been doing field work in the North Woods for over 50 years, and there are lots of places where we had good populations of wood frogs, spring peepers, so forth. Once the turkeys took off, that completely changed. And if you've ever been in the woods where turkeys have hunted, especially in the spring, and you have your spring peepers and your wood frogs that overwinter terrestrially, they pick them off. Same thing with salamanders. And the other thing, especially at this time of year, I used to run a banding station where we had lots of mist nets and we were trapping hawks, but we also caught grackles. And the grackles would come through in huge flocks, sometimes over 1,000, 2,000 birds. And they'd be exploring into woods, they'd be eating grapes, all sorts of things, and they would be flying in the nets. And lo and behold, by a lot of grackles, you will find wood frogs, spring peepers, nets that they picked up in the leaves. Hmm. And so there's a lot of other predators out there.
Yeah, there I would think so. Josh, comment?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. Nobody has ever investigated this in detail, but for the turkeys in particular, that's something I've often wondered about, because there are a couple of anecdotal reports in the literature of turkeys that have been, you know, harvested and dressed during the hunting season, and the hunters have found a juvenile snake or a small snake species in their crop. And so, you know, they're big ground hunting birds. I imagine also, you know, I don't want to anger my ornithologist buddies, but sandhill cranes too, right? Yeah. They're eating tons of stuff off of the, and they're eating a lot. I mean, I've witnessed sandhill cranes eating baby red-winged blackbirds. So I imagine that they would eat a snake they found or a frog very easily. So yeah, those things are certainly predators of those types of herps.
I did want to mention the snake. There's a fungal disease of snakes that is that we have in Wisconsin, and of course a lot of other places as well.
Yes, this is the common term for this is called snake fungal disease. The scientific name is Ophidiomyces ophiodicola, and so Ophidiomyces is a fungus that. So it started to become more noticeable. I don't know if it was necessarily more prominent, but it was definitely more noticeable by researchers, you know, in the 2010, 2015 range. And some work was done on that problem here in Wisconsin, actually, headed up by researchers at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Health Center and the DNR. And I was involved in it as well, and specifically focused on some of our southern communally overwintering snake species. And so the lead researcher on that was an individual named Dr. Jeff Lorch, and he works at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Health Center. And he had explained that, you know, it doesn't behave like an emerging infectious disease. We expect an emerging infectious disease to have sort of an epicenter and then a new introduced disease and all kinds of infections spreading out from that epicenter, right? Where it was first introduced in the location. But this doesn't behave that way. More there, it sort of showed up sporadically in lots of different positions in the eastern U.S. or different locations in the eastern U.S. And so over time, there's been evidence to support that this is probably a very ubiquitous or very common fungus that exists in the soil. And as conditions change, perhaps due to climate change, that fungus becomes more of a pathogen. So there's some work that has found that snakes that overwinter in these communal hibernacula at colder temperatures have a lower instance of infection with snake fungal disease where it shows up. But if they overwinter at the warmer end of that thermal spectrum, then they have a higher instance of that fungal disease in some cases. Mm. So what that would suggest is that as climate increase, or, you know, temperature increases with climate change, maybe that fungus becomes more pathogenic and starts to cause more problems. So it's a disease that causes blisters and welts and like thickened scales and stuff to develop on these snakes. Sometimes it clears, but in really bad infections, it can cause mortality. And it's, you can treat individual snakes, but there's not like a prophylactic type of treatment to protect them in advance. And so they can get these big crusty sores on their mouths where they can't close their mouth all the way.
Can't eat.
They can't breathe well if it gets to that point. So it's it can be a very destructive disease.
And it's sad. I saw some photos of the snakes with that disease, and I felt sorry for them. Man, oh man!
It looks uncomfortable for sure.
It does indeed. Well, Boy, did we get through this and this flu this hour, Josh. Thanks.
We're good.
Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today, and let's do it again.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. And hopefully next time we can get my colleague Donald on the show as well. That would be outstanding to have us both here. Thank you very much, Larry. You are somebody that my entire family has listened to for many, many years. So I am very excited to be on the show with you.
Thanks, Josh. Josh Kapfer is certified wildlife biologist, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at UW-Madison. And when you hear him speak, you know he's very enthusiastic about his area of study, and it's always fun to talk to him, that's for sure. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our great team, Clara Niper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, our executive producers, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. And hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.